Hello, everybody. Welcome to the latest and greatest episode of Inside the Hexagon. I am your host, as always, Phil Lanides, and I want to thank you for taking the time to join us for today's show. On the episode today, I am extremely excited. We have former Strike Force matchmaker Rich Chow on the show. I haven't talked with Rich. It's been about a year since I talked with Rich. We actually discussed having him on the show, but he was working full-time for Bellator at the time, and we weren't sure we were going to be able to make it happen, but he has actually since left that full-time position, although he is still consulting with the promotion and Scott Coker, and he was able to make a lot of time, actually, to be with me, and so this is a really great conversation. We talk about his formative years. I didn't know that he actually fought. He fought once, actually, in MMA before moving over to the, you know, the talent and production side, and so we break down so much. We talk about Strike Force, bring back a lot of good feelings for Rich, and it's just a really, really cool conversation. It's longer than most of our interview episodes, but it's absolutely worth it. Definitely something that you're going to enjoy this for sure. So without further ado, let's get to it. All right. On the line with us, we have the man, the myth, the legend, Rich Chow, former Strike Force matchmaker, now the VP of North America Operations for Wimp to Warrior. Rich, welcome to Inside the Hexagon.
Hey, what's up, Phil? Thanks for I'm very excited to chop it up with you today.
Yeah. I'm really excited about this. You know, we've talked to Scott Coker and you know, you and I talked when you were still working regularly with Bellator about you know, having you come on, and there's, you know, just always some, when you're currently working for promotion, you're talking about another promotion, there's always potentially some issues. So, we were hoping we'd be able to make this work, and here we are. So I'm excited to chat with you as well. So let's kind of go back to the beginning. So, tell us about your entry into MMA. You were, I understand, a star high school athlete. Then you got into MMA, like fighting as a combatant. I didn't realize that you had actually competed inside the cage before. So tell us about what kind of drew you into the sport and how you got involved in MMA as a fighter.
Yeah, sure. So taking it back to really the late 90s is when I fell in love with jiu-jitsu. So that was kind of my entryway into the world of MMA. It started off with jiu-jitsu. It was in the late 90s. I was going to school in Southern California, going to college in Southern California, and started training. And when I had the opportunity after graduation, actually I worked a little bit in like the Calabasas, Thousand Oaks area. And as soon as I got the opportunity, I moved to Hawaii. MMA was legal there at the time, and I really just had this curiosity and this passion and itch I really just had to scratch. So quit my job, moved over there to Hawaii, and started training with Egan Inoue. Egan Inoue, Barrett Yoshida, the whole team. There were so many great guys there. It was a really great environment to be around as a, you know, a 21-year-old just wanting to learn martial arts, and just find out what this MMA thing was all about, and ended up fighting around 2002. I've actually fought in a ring. It was Super okay. Brawl at right. the time. So right. fought in the ring, took the fight on a few days' notice.
That was TJ Thompson's promotion.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. That's how I first met TJ, and lost a decision. My coaches were actually pretty satisfied with it, given who the opponent was and the amount of time I had been training. And, you know, so they got all excited, and I wanted to put me on this path to, you know, continue to take these fights in Super Brawl. And, you know, after that fight, which was an amazing experience, I'm very glad I had a chance to do it, learned a lot from it. And after that fight, shortly after, I met the Penn family. And they were promoting an event called Rumble on the Rock.
Right.
And so that's where I really transitioned from, you know, I had the fight, and it was like I was at the crossroads, you know. There was an opportunity to continue to fight with the team. And like I said, my coaches were satisfied with what they saw, and they felt like, hey, you know, with some more experience, I could be okay. And then over here on the other side, I met this really awesome family that were doing big things in the MMA world. And obviously, you know, BJ, right. It was exciting to meet him and get a chance to get to know him better and learn from him. So I ended up kind of veering away from the fight path, the fight career, and heading into the promotional side.
Yeah.
So it was a very, you know, short-lived foray into actual competition, but I'm very grateful for it. And I have no regrets about kind of the decision I made at that point to kind of venture more into the business / promotional side of things instead of, you know, continuing down the path of taking more fights.
Yeah, fewer punches in the face, right? So
yeah, you know, definitely. But that experience and that type of training that I've been able to do over the years has certainly helped me in my various roles in the MMA promotional side, you know, to understand what a fighter has to go through, you know, from a weight cut to the hard training, to the preparation, to obviously, like you said, getting your face punched. I've been in that situation before. And I think understanding that and understanding what a fighter goes through has been very helpful in my career.
Yeah. You know, it's being that Scott Coker was a, you know, a successful competitor in, you know, competitive karate and, you know, so MMA wasn't really around at that point, but him having that, I think you can probably speak to this more, but probably made him have more respect in the eyes of fighters. Same thing with you versus guys like Dana, who, you know, have never, you know, supposedly he did some boxing, amateur boxing at some point, but being that you guys actually competed in the sport or something adjacent to the sport, I would think that that gave you a little bit more cachet and respect with the fighters because you do understand what they go through. And I think, you know, that makes sense. That would help you with that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's fun to, and I honestly don't do this enough, but I love training with everyone that we work with. Just really, as a fan, as a passionate martial artist, but also professionally, you know, to help get sharper, to learn, to understand things better. Cause, you know, my job for the last, you know, almost two decades now has been to evaluate talent. And if you don't know, you know, what true talent is, and if you don't know the sport, like on that level, like yeah. it just helped me get better. Just have more of a trained eye and just understanding training and fight culture in that at that level has been very helpful because I do feel like perhaps not enough people have it. You know, you have a lot of fans and perhaps people who are very articulate, you know, can speak well, can write well, just sharp dudes, but they don't really have that background.
Yeah.
I think, you know, perhaps they may not, you know, really, really have a full grasp. You know, I've since day one, I've tried my best, Phil, to learn everything. I've done everything there is to do. I've refereed over 100 fights in Hawaii. I fought, competed in several jiu-jitsu tournaments. I've been in several training camps in various capacities and obviously, you know, promoted and matched several fights in various organizations. So I've always tried my best to get as much experience in this game, in this industry, in this sport, however you want to describe it, as much as possible.
Well, I do want to jump back to, you know, those formative years because it is important. And like you said, you've been in the business or the, like you said, business sport, whatever you want to call it for, you know, around almost 20 years. But you crossed over into the Rumble on the Rock promotion in 2004, and between Super Brawl and Rumble on the Rock, Hawaii doesn't get the attention, I think, from a sport, like a historical perspective as it should when it comes to MMA, because I mean, you know, you have the Penn brothers, of course, JD, you know, more on the business side, but, you know, BJ, and then there's Carlos Condit, Jake Shields, Eddie Alvarez, Cabbage Correa, you know, Tank Abbott fought there, Tim Sylvia, Anderson Silva. I mean, there's so many names from history that, you know, some guys that are like Carlos had just retired, Eddie's still active, you know, there's so many big names that fought there that, you know, it's crazy. So I'm curious, help like crossing over to that more talent, you know, operations side, did you feel like, all right, this is my calling, like this is what I want to do, and I, you know, don't know how long I'm going to be here for 20 years necessarily, but Did you feel like, man, this is it? This is what I want to do. I'm enjoying this.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, thanks for recognizing Hawaii and what a special place it is for MMA. All the names you mentioned, there's several others. You know,
that was off the top of my head. I know totally. There's others.
Yeah, we could spend the entire day going over the rich history and you know, all the amazing guys that have fought in Hawaii and helped contribute and build the scene over there. Yeah, look, right place, right time for me, man. I'm so lucky. You know, I was just a kid at that time that loved MMA, loved jiu-jitsu, had this curiosity and passion for it. Just met the right people at the right time. And Hawaii really was the hotspot for MMA prior to this boom, you know, prior mm-hmm. to kind of the, I would say, you know, the TV era, kind of the quote yeah. unquote mainstream era. So many guys just wanted to fight. I mean, the sport wasn't even legal in California.
Right.
You know,
right.
when I was getting going, right. much less New York, right. Which just happened.
Yeah. Really just recently. Happened. Right.
Yeah. So when you think about it back then, all those guys, you know, first of all, it's not difficult to convince someone to go visit Hawaii. Right.
Right.
In my experience, I can tell you that we were able to get better deals because the guys just said, hey, I'll fight for you for this. Can I stay for a few extra days? You know what I mean? Like it's a very cool and fun and special place just to visit. And I think that really helped contribute to, you know, why people really wanted to go there and compete. And just me being there at that time, at that era with the guys that I was with, man, I'm just so blessed. I would not be here today if I didn't have that, you know, that experience, that's for sure.
Yeah. I'll quickly share the only time I've ever been to Hawaii was for an MMA event. I was working with, I think Christine Miller was her name it was X Events. And, we did an event there where, Satoshi Ishii was fighting an exhibition fight. And it was at, Blaisdell Arena. And, I showed up, I was doing PR for the event. It was an internet pay-per-view thing. And I show up and the ring announcer is wearing like a cabbie hat with like a t-shirt and shorts. And I was just like, well, that's not cool. Like I was in like a sport coat and, you know,
right.
I'm like, all right, dude, come on. And I know it's Hawaii, but I just like, all right, so will you do it? I was like, fine, I'll do it. So I announced like the preliminary card, which I've never done in my life, but I'm like, sure, I'll do this. So first off, I got the cards mixed up and there was a Russian guy fighting a Hawaiian guy and I mislabeled them. And I knew it after the first guy, cause I announced the Russian guy and the Hawaiian guy walks out and I'm like, well, that guy's not Russian. So, and then what do? Just repeat the same names. Like, so I had to announce the Hawaiian guy when the Russian guy came out, even though I knew it was wrong. And then I said like Blaisdell or something instead of Blaisdell. And the crowd, there was like 3,000 people there, just started booing me and they pretty much booed me out of the cage for messing up the name. And I was like, in a way they saved me because there was more like Felinico Vitale was on the card. So I knew how to say that name, but there were some Hawaiian names on there that I did not know how to say. So
oh my goodness,
it would have gotten really bad like later. So I after that was the end of the prelim part, which thankfully wasn't televised. And I walk out of the cage. And the dude's like standing there just kind of smirking at me like, all right, how'd that go? And I was just,
man. Hey.
I just handed him the mic and walked away. And that was the end of my, the end of my ring announcing career.
You got thrown into deep water, huh?
Yeah. Right off the bat. Well, I didn't get thrown in. I dove in like a moron. Sure. So. Yeah. But yeah, anyways, I've
been there and done that, man. Sometimes that's the best way to learn.
Yeah. Bad. I learned I wasn't cut out for that. So
yeah, but very similar to my fight experience, you know, one of those situations 2 days out, coach runs up to me. Hey man, you know, there's an opening now, you know, one of your training partners, that's your weight, you know, lost him this morning to injury. He's off the card. You want to step in? And, you know, there was deep water right there. And yeah, like just much like yourself, I decided to jump in instead of taking a step back. So sometimes you just got to throw caution to the wind.
And just do it.
Go for it, huh?
Yeah. Even if it ends up just being a funny story later on, you know?
So. Yeah, totally. That's a great story, man.
Yeah. Well, so after Rumble on the Rock, you get the opportunity with Elite XC. I believe TJ Thompson was one of the guys with Elite XC, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, you know, so JD called me one day. He goes, "Hey, you know, I just met these guys. They're going big." You know, just a very great call where he was really excited. And just basically said, it's time to step up. It's time to, you know, we're going to hit the road and go meet these guys in LA soon and just be ready. But I think this is what we've been working towards. You know, it's this great opportunity. So we were actually the first guys brought in as consultants. We were the first guys. TJ and some other guys came on board later as Pro Elite, the parent company, started absorbing more of these regional promotions.
Right. Bought a bunch of them. Yeah.
Yeah. Including Icon Sport at the time, where Super Brawl evolved into Icon Sport. So that's where, you know, TJ got more involved and, you know, we started, you know, doing the shows together in Hawaii and that's where, you know, really it's, you know, since we're talking about TJ, where my relationship with him kind of changed because, as I mentioned earlier, I started off, I fought for him, you know, and from there I became his competitor and his rival as he was doing Icon and we were doing Rumble on the Rock. It's a small island. So, you know, he was the veteran. He was the OG that was like, oh, who the hell are these young kids trying to, you know, tap into my market and tap into what I've helped create over here. And so there was a mostly friendly rivalry and competition going on there.
Kind of frenemies.
Yeah, totally. And then we full circle, you know, we work at the same company. We're working together. We're on the same side and him and I remain good friends to this day. But that was cool to see everybody come together again, being in a position where I could learn from someone like TJ, you know, who was one of the pioneers here.
Yeah.
Forget about Hawaii, just in America.
Yeah.
You know, he was one of the guys, you know, that really helped bring MMA really onto the scene, you know. And there were several other promotions and organizations that got involved with what we were doing. And I really tried my best to learn from all of them, you know, different regions over in Europe, Asia, you know, other parts of the country. Just really having that experience. There's a lot of people that obviously have a lot to say about Elite XC as a whole and kind of what happened there with the company. But I did my best to learn from the people that were involved that I really respected and that were doing good things.
Well, another guy that was really respected and doing good things was the aforementioned Scott Coker. And there ended up being a partnership, a kind of a co-promoting relationship between Elite XC and Strikeforce before Elite XC went under. And so I want to talk about your transition over to Strikeforce, but is this how you met Scott? And then what were your thoughts at that point on Scott and Strikeforce? Were you looking over there as, oh, this is competition or man, they're doing good things. Like what was your perspective on Scott and Strikeforce at that point?
Well, you know, I actually first met Scott a few years prior to Elite XC, when I was at Rumble on the Rock. So Scott was putting on the K1 events in Vegas.
That's right.
And we were Rumble on the Rock. We were putting on the K1 events in Hawaii.
Ah, okay.
So Scott came, I believe I met him before, we did a few shows with K1 and the main events were BJ versus Rodrigo Gracie and BJ versus Henzo Gracie. So I remember meeting Scott, at one of those shows. Can't specifically remember which one, but I remember meeting him in Waikiki, sitting down and, you know, just a really, really just nice guy. I felt like he was observing us, you know, like just taking it all in, kind of feeling us out as we were doing the same with him, but very nice. I knew that he was doing great things in Vegas with the K1 events there. And then shortly after, I remember making the transition to Elite XC and then seeing him put on the first event in California. I mean, over at the Shark Tank. I mean, we had friends that were outside trying to get in, just calling us like, holy shit, guys, it's freaking packed. Like,
yeah, I was there. I was there in the building.
This is crazy. Like, I think we're going to get in, but man, you know, this exceeded our expectations. And, you know, so I knew he was a great promoter. I knew he was doing big things. And when we did the co-promotions with Strikeforce, I even got to see more of how he was just like, you know, he had San Jose and just kind of the, you know, he had the martial arts community united over here tremendously. Like, he was just a great promoter, yeah. You know, to get in there. And what's funny is the whole relationship, how we started co-promoting, it didn't really come together like organically. It was kind of forced, you know, through some legal issues where the settlement was between the two companies was hey, you guys got to co-promote, right? So you're kind of coming in and I'm like, hey, Scott, good to see you again, you know, but there's a little bit of that tension. Mm-hmm. But I think he recognized that, you know, I certainly wasn't, you know, behind it all or kind of leading and driving it. But, you know, we got past that. We got a chance to get to know each other better and learn from each other. And I was just very impressed with what I saw when I got a chance to kind of, you know, go behind the curtain with him and see how he ran he was running Strikeforce at the time. It was really cool.
Well, obviously you impressed him as well, because after Elite XC folds in the fall of 2008, you're brought in shortly afterwards to help with matchmaking for Strikeforce. And before that, from what I understand and the interviews I've done, I've talked with Javier Mendez, I've talked with Scott. It wasn't really like an official matchmaker. It was like Scott, Javier and mostly Bob were doing like a lot of the matchmaking with Scott, basically. And then you come in. So I believe you were like the first official matchmaker, really, besides Scott for Strikeforce. So I'm curious, even though your run with the promotion actually ended up not being super, super long. I mean, you were with them for 2.5 years, basically.
Yeah.
From when you came on to, you know, after the acquisition, the Zufa acquisition, you stuck around for a little bit. But I'm curious, did you like kind of consult a little bit, or did you start matchmaking right away? What was the first card that you would say that you booked for Strikeforce? You'd say, I was the matchmaker for this card.
Yeah. You know, that is accurate. What you mentioned earlier, the whole situation and the structure, you know, there was no official matchmaker because Hav and Bob were running a gym.
Yeah. They're AKA. So it's like, I totally understood that. I was like, you can't be like running a gym and then you're matching up fight. Like everybody's going to think that you're being, you know, you're preferring your guys. So yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I think that position, whoever sits in that chair as the official matchmaker needs to, you know, you certainly can't be managing and training guys, you know, you really got to be independent. And so, yeah, when I got brought in, and it was made official, yeah, I was the first, and last, I guess, but, my first, you know, to get things going, I was brought in to, yeah, just consult, kind of, you know, be around the group, make sure it was a good fit for both sides. You know, Scott at that time, it's funny, you know, he used the expression, you know, let's date before we get married. Right. And I couldn't agree more, because, you know, the ultimately the job entailed a big life change. You know, I was living in Hawaii. He needed someone up in San Jose. Yep. So before we got, you know, too far down the line, let's just make sure that this is going to be a good fit, that I was going to get along with the team. So I remember going to, I want to say the first event that I went to may have been Lawler Shields in St. Louis.
Okay.
You know, so I flew out there and, you know, spent time and helped out with the team, and helped the team out during fight week for that one. And then I want to say after Carano Cyborg, I remember meeting Scott the next day and, you know, getting the official offer, and we started talking about making the move. And yeah, that was kind of the timeline that I remember. So I came in, worked a couple big events. We both made sure this was going to be a good fit, and fortunately it was. And then, yeah, after Carano Cyborg, you know, he asked me to move up as quickly as I could and really, really jump in there, because for him, I think he needed somebody again with no conflict of interest. It was time, because he was going at that moment from a really great regional show, you know, to a big national and really international brand. Right.
Yeah.
And I think he needed somebody in there full time without any conflicts, and just somebody that was going to be fully committed to that role?
Well, I mean, timing worked out well, and I just happened to, I was quickly kind of looking up dates, but the Lawler Shields card, I think, was June of 09. And then obviously Karana Cyborg was in August of 09. And then the next card was actually Fedor's Strikeforce debut. So Fedor versus Rogers. So that's obviously, that's a big one to, you know, kind of be jumping in on basically. But I want to talk about the matchmaking aspect of it. So you've said in interviews that creating the matchups in the quote unquote war room is, you know, the easiest part of matchmaking, that it's actually putting them together that can be difficult. You have to deal with injuries, contract disputes, you know, other challenges, stuff like that. You and I actually had a discussion. You may not even remember this, but you and I actually had a discussion about this once, because I was managing Lyle Fancy Pants Beer Bomb for a cup of coffee. And I remember talking to you because we were trying to line up his next fight. And I believe it ended up being the Vitor Shaolin Ribeiro fight. And I was just trying to get Lyle a bigger name, like not than Shaolin, but than his last fight. And so, I mean, his contract called for a certain amount. There wasn't really much to really negotiate, and he needed a fight. So it wasn't like it was like a 10-minute phone call. It was nothing really major, but I you know, obviously dealing with, you know, M1 for Fedor, dealing with, you know, the various guys that you have over the years, was matchmaking for Strikeforce any different than Rumble on the Rock, your time, you know, with Pro Elite, with Bellator? Like, was there anything that made it easier or harder with Strikeforce, or was it pretty much like, you know, it's the same everywhere because you're dealing with athletes?
It was definitely different. It was a big step up for me because we were transitioning from, you know, with Elite XC, there were several people involved because of the various organizations that we worked with. So we were always trying to pull from those organizations, right. To bring into the mothership, so to speak. But this was the first time it was really like, hey, we need to assemble a roster here, you know, and really build this thing out.
Yeah.
And
Strikeforce branded fighters.
Yeah. And that's the challenge, is when you sit down and say, all right, this is our vision, these are the guys who we believe in, you know, because I do think you need to have layers, right? You need your elite level guys that are championship, you know, caliber guys now. You need your contenders, you need your future contenders. Like that's the thing that's tricky, is building the roster out and really building those layers, as opposed to just once they're there, it's easy. You know, this guy fight that guy, like it's you know it's gonna be a great fight. Like those things just kind of come together naturally when you have a great roster. So I've always felt like the challenge is building a great roster, first of all. And then I'm gonna deal with all the other issues over time, the injuries, the contract disputes, all those different things that can happen that'll disrupt your business. But I think the key is building out a strong roster and continuing to, you know, just have it grow and also just have it flow. You know, not everyone's going to stay on forever, right? You got to, if you're getting rid of guys, you're bringing in new guys that you feel can contribute. So it's just a constant maintenance of the roster is what I think personally is the greatest challenge. And then once you're there, once you build a strong roster, it just gets a little easier for you. As far as match, just making the matches, of course, like we've said, you got to deal with all the that can happen in between, but build yourself a strong roster and it'll make your job easier.
Okay. Well, you definitely had a lot of talent to work with. You know, like we said, the run with Strikeforce ended up being about 2.5 years. What do you consider to be highlights? I mean, for a matchmaker, is a highlight that, like, oh, I put together this main event and it drew really well, and you know the guys perform really well. Is it like you push for a fight that Scott or, you know, Bob or somebody else didn't necessarily think would work and ended up just being a great fight, or you help build this guy, you know, you had faith in this one guy or this one gal who, you know, that ended up really becoming a star that you discovered, you found that diamond in the rough. What kind of stands out in your mind as highlights for your time matchmaking with them?
I think there were several, great moments. I think several, what's the best way to word this? You know, I wouldn't say guesses, but just several guys that, you know,
maybe you had a feeling about.
Yeah. That we did believe in, that we thought could be could be great. And it ended up that, you know, playing out that they were, you know, that they were great. Unfortunately, it wasn't with Strikeforce, but, you know, in a crazy way, their success, you know, the guys that moved on that I'm referring to, their success in the UFC really validated what we were doing and what we had done, you know? Yeah. So I think that the ability to identify talent, groom and develop talent was highlighted with these guys doing well and climbing, you know, to the top of the mountain in the UFC. Right. I think Strikeforce, it was, you know, one of Strikeforce's greatest contributions was kind of shattering certain myths, you know, that there are only the best guys in the UFC. I think Strikeforce really to this day is a great example and case study of how that's really not the case. And that was really, I think, the first organization that really put a stamp on that, you know, with Woodley, you know, Tyron Woodley, Luke Rockhold, Daniel Cormier, obviously, amongst others, you know, the guys that made the transition over, ended up doing very, very well over in the UFC. So clearly, there can be great talent in other organizations.
Yeah. How about the female fighters? You know, they're, if there's Strikeforce is the promotion that gave them the platform to be, you know, women's fights obviously existed before that, but without Strikeforce, there may be no, you know, Ronda Rousey, no Chris Cyborg, no Miesha Tate. Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
Carlos, again, that's another great example of how, of the contribution, I think, to the big picture, you know, another contribution Strikeforce made and we made through our efforts. You know, Fedor losing to Verdum here in San Jose. Like, you know, these are big moments in the sport. That I was just lucky to be a part of, and that, you know, it was great to see him play out in the organization. But I think that just proved that how relevant we were, you know, we were onto something, we were putting on big relevant fights that kind of dictated, you know, who, you know, it really showed us and helped us. And it really helped the sport evolve. You know, it showed us again, breaking certain myths and legends and really just showing us, just being a part of the progress of the sport. You know, I think questions were answered, and I think we were very, very relevant as far as that goes. Because, you know, it's cool to pack arenas, which we were able to do and get great viewership and, you know, do all that. But the big picture wise, I think we were important to the growth of the sport and really help take it to the next level.
Yeah. It's an important, that's part of the reason we're doing the podcast. It's an important part of the history of the sport, you know? So, well, I got one more question about Strikeforce, and then I did want to talk about Wim to Warrior before we wrap things up. So in your mind, actually, it's kind of a two-part question. In your mind, what was the biggest fight that you made in Strikeforce? And then to the acquisition, what were your thoughts at the time of Scott selling the promotion to Dana in the UFC? And for listeners as context, the idea was not that Strikeforce would be, you know, absorbed or anything. I mean, Strikeforce was supposed to run as a separate standalone promotion, but then the UFC starts bringing over its, you know, its best fighters, and it ends up, you know, kind of bleeding it. And then, you know, they end up having, you know, end up folding it. But is there a fight that, you know, before the acquisition happened, you're like, this is the biggest fight that I made in Strikeforce? And then your thoughts when you heard that Scott was going to be selling?
You know, as far as biggest fight, I think at that time, you know, the Fedor fights really, I think really, really stood out and really put everyone on notice.
I mean, they drew the best ticket sales and ratings post Frank Shamrock. Yeah. They really, you know, they're really the shows that did the best.
Yeah, I think the Fedor fights were always huge, you know, help get us back on network TV, back on CBS.
For a little while. Thank you. Thank you, Jake. And Nashville.
I know where you are right now.
I can still feel the ghosts around here.
Now we exercised those demons last time I was there. Brought someone with me. We had a little ritual and we took care of that. But, you know, at that time, honestly, the Fedor fights were huge because, I mean, look, he's to me, he's the GOAT heavyweight.
Yeah, absolutely.
And back then, as I mentioned earlier, it just showed, you know, he didn't win them all, but it just, we were relevant, and we were able to be a part of history in kind of, I wouldn't say by any means were we, you know, celebrating his decline or anything like that, but questions were answered. You know, this was a big moment in history where, you know, you saw him lose, and then you saw him, you know, and just where that took other people's careers and where that all led, you know, into the heavyweight Grand Prix and ultimately with the sale. Right. Yeah. So I think when I look back at that moment, I think there are, there may not have been bigger moments than the Fedor moments, you know. What do you think?
Yeah. I mean, it's tough to top the, you know, the Frank Shamrock, Cesar Gracie, not that that was a great fight, but that moment, 18,000 people there, you know, I was at the last, Strikeforce kickboxing event in the same arena, the previous year. And there was like 3,000 people there, and I was the only journalist. So, quote unquote, in the room. And, you know, that was at Press Row basically. And so to go from that to the next year, 18,000, that's pretty hard to top, you know, from just like a promotional standpoint. I mean, the Josh Thompson, Gilbert Melendez trilogy, I mean, you know, something that's almost entirely Strikeforce. Carano Cyborg, I was there that night as well. And that was an amazing atmosphere. And the fact that those ladies, you know, essentially drew such a huge house and all, I mean,
and that was the first time, sorry to interrupt, but just to add to that, it was the first time I believe that women had headlined a major promotion on television.
Yeah,
so
it was.
Yeah, there's just so many great things that happened.
Yeah.
And again, why we were relevant and how we helped contribute to growing and building the sport at that time. It was really cool. Very lucky to have been there. But it just seems like, you know, Fedor coming in, being the greatest fighter in the world at that time, where his career went from there. Those just felt like the biggest moments. I mean, there's so many fun fights we had. As you mentioned, Caesar versus Frank is huge in its own right, but for different reasons. You know, like the question of that was like a great grudge match, and obviously the Bay Area was really into it. But the title of the best fighter in the world or the GOAT wasn't on the line that night.
Right. Oh yeah.
Know what I mean? Like like that. But that evening had its own significance, just like Carano Cyborg did, just like, you know, Fedor Rogers was back on CBS. And then, you know, Fedor Verdum is where kind of we saw the GOAT, you know.
Yeah. Broke my heart. You know,
yeah, look, like everyone else. I specifically remember sitting cage side and seeing it all play out. And he taps, and I'm sitting near the corner of near Verdum's corner. And then Babalu turns to me. He's crying.
Wow.
And then they start, you know, trying to jump in the cage. Bob and I had to go and, you know, control that situation along with, you know, our staff. And I remember that moment, you know, Thompson Melendez, you know, that was an awesome trilogy. You know, just so many great moments, and just reminiscing with you, just get, man, it just makes me feel good right now. I feel proud, and most of all, I feel very lucky, man, that I got that chance to be a part of it. So thank you, Scott.
Yeah. Thank you, Scott. Seriously. Well, I did ask the question of how you felt about when, you know, Scott said they was going to be selling the promotion. I would imagine that was disappointing, but I'm curious as I did want to see that question through.
Yes. I was surprised. Definitely surprised. That is just one of the many experiences. Granted, it's a big one, but I've been just through so much in this industry. The ups and downs have been just insane. You know, one minute you're celebrating an epic success and, you know, breaking a record or establishing a new benchmark. And the next minute, you know, you're bought out, or the next minute, you know, you're on the verge of going on. It just, the ups and downs feel that. That is one of the many experiences that kind of really, you know, personally and professionally toughened me up, man. Like, this is a crazy industry. It's extremely volatile. You're going to have to be calm and just remain steadfast to get through these kind of situations. And the aftermath of that, you know, it could have gone, you know, things could have gone, you know, there was like all these different directions at that time. I'm like dealing with this, you know, and I'm like, man, I could do this, I can do that. There was just a lot of room to overreact. There was a real test, you know, it was a real test. Look, Scott and I continue to work together,
right?
Even to this day, you know, I'm not the official matchmaker anymore, but we still,
together on some
projects.
Yeah, still consulting, right?
Yeah. So I think that says a lot, that we've been through a lot, and that, you know, when things get tough and things get, you know, things take a turn for the worse, like, how are you going to respond? Are you going to freak out and, you know, do something you may regret later? That, you know, there's just so many, this could have played out in a lot of different ways. Like, there were some people that haven't really fully recovered from that, you know, they kind of took it in this direction and, you know, did their own thing. And just the way I handled it was the best way for me. And, that experience, just like I said, toughened me up personally and professionally and put me in a situation to where today, I'm not freaking out when there's these types of situations, you know. That's a big, you know, to be just doing such a great job and to be celebrated and enjoy. People were rooting for us back then, Phil.
Oh, yeah.
I really,
yeah,
really felt that. It was, yeah, cool. Like, we were the underdogs,
yep,
who were putting on these fun shows and doing these cool things and going for it. And just overnight, boom, to just be like, you know, unemployed and just kind of trying to figure out what to do next. You know, you could overreact and say and do some things that could put you in a really bad situation. And thankfully, I didn't. I remained resilient and quiet and just observed more than I listened and watched more than I spoke. And I just let everything play out. And fortunately, I guess I made the right moves at that time during a very turbulent time.
Well, it did end up working out. I believe you worked with a clothing maker, RCVA, for a while, and then end up, once Scott takes the reins of Bellator, you end up being the matchmaker there as well. 2014 and 2021, you know, you oversaw a lot of growth within the promotion. Obviously, the Bellator is much different than it was back then, but, you know, 7 successful years. Then April of this year, 2021, you decided to leave your full-time role there at Bellator for an opportunity with a new company, Wimp to Warrior, which is a fitness program where participants spend 20 weeks working with top coaches and training partners, learning everything from striking, grappling, strength, conditioning, all of that, with the end goal being having the option of having an amateur bout, which sounds very cool to me. But being that you were, and I know your family, your children are growing up and you want to be able to be there for them and all that. So that it makes sense from that perspective, but it's definitely, you know, a risk on your part. So, you know, I want to hear about, you know, this huge decision to leave Bellator, and yes, you're still consulting with them, but, you know, I'd like to hear about Wimp to Warrior and what you all are doing there and what grabbed you so much about their mission that made you comfortable leaving that full-time role with Bellator to go to this new role.
Yeah. You know, there's some guys that, were very shocked when I made the move. And,
I was one of them, by the way.
Yeah, look, some people probably, you know, think and thought that I was just absolutely crazy to give up one of the few gigs there are out there. You know, there's probably 4 or 5.
Yeah. Full-time. Yeah.
At level. Yes. Where you're just operating at that high level, you know, doing elite championship caliber world-class MMA. Yeah. There aren't that many gigs out there. But I just felt it was my time to continue to learn, grow, and evolve. You know, entering my 40s, being a father, having done this for the better, you know, part of the last 2 decades, I just felt like it was a time to learn, grow, and evolve and just mix things up. And, you know, fortunately, the Wimp to Warrior opportunity was there for me to embrace. And, man, to still be able to be involved with my passion, it was like a very smooth, seamless transition to go from fight promoting to, you know, the Wimp to Warrior business. Because, yeah, I'm still working with the same guys. We're still working with great coaches. We're still involved in the world of MMA training and doing really good things. To me, to transition from, hey, let's look for the best guys in the world, let's put on the biggest fights we can, to, hey, let's get everyday people to go out and be better, you know, train, learn martial arts. I mean, to me, the more I'm involved, the more I feel like it's more mental than physical, you know, to really help people do things that they couldn't do. You know, this is just a really great way to build that confidence, self-esteem, and just get people to be a better version, you know, to be better versions of themselves. So when I saw that, I thought, look, that's a great challenge. That's a great opportunity. It's a great way to help the sport grow, just in a different manner. But yeah, we're out there trying to capitalize on the growth of the sport from a fan perspective. Like, we have all these fans that are fascinated and love watching these fights. Well, our goal is to reach out to them and get them to take the next step and learn more about the sport and train and just get involved and train and go to their you know, to the great gyms in their areas. In fact, for you, Phil, in Nashville, we have a great partner there.
Yeah, Nashville MMA.
That's right.
Chandler's gym.
That's right. And yep, we're going to be running a program there early next year. I'm inviting you. I'm challenging you.
Okay.
Challenge to go in there, train, learn. And it's great to get fit, right? It's great to learn martial arts, learn new things, learn a great skill. But I think the things that it can do for you mentally and spiritually are really going to benefit you for the rest of your life, you know, whether you continue to train or not. And it's just a really great, just a pure, you know, a pure goal that I saw. And I'm like, you know what? This just feels right. I'd love to jump on board. I've tried to grow the sport, done my best to grow it through events. And now I'm going to try my best to help gyms grow and to help the sport grow through participation and just getting more people on the mat, learning and just having fun with what we all love.
Yeah. Well, I we're just about out of time, so I want to ask one more question, but it's wimptowarrior.com. I checked out the site in preparation for this, and that's where I saw, when you look up a location, you put in your zip code and it'll tell you the closest gym that's participating. And I saw it was Nashville MMA, which I, like I said, is Michael Chandler's gym. So I was, and there's some really cool testimonials on the site as well. And I'm intrigued and yeah, I'm down. I would love to give it a try. So it seems like a great program. There's some really great names involved in this, obviously, including Rich, including you. So again, whiptowarrior.com, definitely worth checking out and checking out if there's a gym that's affiliated in your area. And I'm planning to look into it further. But one final question before I let you go. Out of, you know, Super Brawl, Rumble on the Rock, Strikeforce, Bellator, all your years in the sport, what is your favorite fight that you were cage side for? Whether you made the match or not, what's the fight that stands out as, this is my favorite fight and why?
Man, that is a really, really good one. Man, there are so many. Man, look at you.
I'll quickly tell you one that stands out in my mind for me
thinking
about it, was the Fedor Verdun one. Not because I was there in the press box, and it's not my favorite because I'm such a huge Fedor Mark fan, whatever you want to call it, like such a huge fan. I was genuinely saddened when he lost. Like I was like, saw his head turning purple and I'm like, no, this is Fedor. Like he's going to get out of it. There's no way. But it's a minute into the fight, no sweat, you know, and you got a world, like legit world champion Brazilian jiu-jitsu player, like, you know, that was there. In retrospect, it was actually fairly easy, but the reaction of the crowd, it's the only time I could think of that I would describe as a hushed roar, that it was just like there was reaction, but it wasn't cheering, it wasn't booing, it was just like reaction. And so that moment, even though it was sad for me personally, has always stuck out in my mind. So it wasn't so much the action in the cage, it was more the emotion that it elicited from the crowd. And that's what makes that moment stand out in my mind more than pretty much any other than I wasn't cage side for it, but I was there, was the Shamrock Gracie, you know, that first one, just surveying 18,000 people. And I was somebody that I considered to be an early support. I was there, you know, for Strikeforce. I was an early supporter of the promotion. It was my home promotion. And seeing, like, even though I didn't know any of those guys yet, I hadn't met Scott, I hadn't met Frank, you know, I hadn't met any of those guys, to see what they had pulled off, like, was just, you know, I was proud, even though I wasn't even really a part of it other than just being there. So my moments are more about, again, the reaction and the emotion and, you know, the excitement from the crowd versus like what actually happened in the cage. So I don't know if that helps your answer at all.
It does. And you described that scene perfectly, by the way. That's exactly, yeah, I'll never forget it. You know, you described it perfectly. You know, people's jaws, like,
yeah,
to walk around and pick them up off the floor, man. Yeah. They were just dropped. No one expected that.
Yeah.
You know, for me, there's so many, you know, they're not necessarily the biggest events, you know, as far as, you know, gate, attendance, ratings, you know, they're just kind of more personal things, you know, for me. There are quite a few. It'd be difficult for me to just, you know, name one, but I, you know, two that off the top of my head and what I'm feeling right now at this moment, I'd say BJ versus Renzo Gracie. That was at Aloha Stadium. That was the first time an event had been in the stadium. We did that in conjunction with K1, and man, it was like, that was the first time we just dreamt big, you know, what's the biggest thing we can do? Just a couple of local boys in Hawaii sitting down, martial arts geeks, just thinking big, you know. That was the first event that really, when we pulled that off, I was like, we can do anything. You know, we brought Renzo all the way over here to fight BJ. K1 is broadcasting this event, you know, all over the world. We're in Aloha Stadium, you know, like this is monumental. And just a couple guys, obviously we had K1 backing us and supporting us, but really we were the guys on the ground putting all of this together. And I think, so that event, although it's not one of those like all time great classic fights that people talk about, again, what it meant to me and what it gave me and what I felt after, you know, that certainly was a big milestone, which led directly, you know, to getting an opportunity to put on Shamrock versus Gracie for the first Elite XC event, and to take that, have that confidence and that experience to build off that, to take that right into, we're launching MMA on premium cable. We're the guys that got that opportunity. And without the stadium show, you know, to have that imagination and confidence, you know, I think that's where we first got it, was it was great putting on shows at the Blaisdell, but several people had done that before, you know, and to put on BJ versus Renzo and what that meant for the fight community, the jiu-jitsu community, you know, perhaps that event, I think was like, I felt like the first big show, man, Phil, where I just got a where I got a taste of it and I got the confidence that I could be a part of it and I can pull it off, you know, with the right team. So
awesome. That's a good answer. Well, Rich, I really appreciate you taking the time to do this. I've really enjoyed this. It's been great, you know, sort of reminiscing, but also, reminiscing and then also learning a lot. So I appreciate your time. Thank you for being on Inside the Hexagon.
Thank you, man. This was a lot of fun. I'm going to go watch some Strikeforce fights now and continue this great nostalgic moment. But no, thank you very much. I'm glad you are celebrating a very special time in the sport. I know as we move on, you know, people tend to forget things. The best thing you saw was the last thing you saw, kind of. Right. We're in that generation of consumption and media the way it is. And it's nice that, you know, people remember the roots and remember the guys that helped contribute most notably and throughout this conversation, Scott Coker. So, you know, I want to just take this moment to thank him again. I do it often, but perhaps not often enough, you know. Thanks, Scott, for the opportunity that he gave me. Just helped my dreams come true, man. So thanks for acknowledging all the work we did at that time.
All right, I want to thank my very special guest, Rich Chow, for taking the time to be with me on the show. I really, really enjoyed reconnecting with Rich and getting his insights into, you know, his time with Strikeforce, of course, but also talking about his formative years, and then, you know, touching a little bit on his Bellator years, and then of course the Wimp to Warrior program, which I'm excited about. I'm digging in deeper. I'm really going to check it out and see if it's something I can make work. I would really, really like to do that. So very cool conversation with Rich, and he took an extra long time with me, which again, I really appreciate, and I hope that you really enjoyed as well. Hope that you're also enjoying our other content. Coming up, we are going to be covering Strikeforce Feijão versus Henderson, which, as you may have guessed, featured a main event with the light heavyweight title on the line, with Feijão defending his title against Dan Henderson. In the co-main event, Marlos Kunin puts her women's bantamweight belt on the line against Liz Carmouche. You've also got Tim Kennedy versus Melvin Manhoef. So this is a good one. I'm looking forward to covering this card, and I think it's going to be a lot of fun to dive into it with Josh. Then the week after that, we have another big name, the man himself, Tim Kennedy. I've already interviewed him, and it's a great chat. We talk about his time with Strikeforce. He obviously, from the interview, you can hear it, he just really enjoyed and misses Strikeforce. And so we talk about the fight with Melvin. We talk about the mindset that went into it and the execution, and then just kind of Tim's overall run with the promotion. So it's a really good educational opportunity and interview. I mean, I learned some things that I didn't know before. So that's going to be coming up. But with that, we're going to go ahead and wrap things up. You can, of course, follow us on social media. You can find us on Twitter and on Instagram at The Hexagon Pod. And you can reach me at phil@insidethehexagon.com. And then I haven't asked for this in a while, but I would love for you to rate and review the show. If you can take a couple minutes on Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star rating and review, I mean, that would just be awesome. It helps others find the show, and I would really appreciate that. And of course, you can find us on evergreenpodcast.com. You can find other Evergreen podcasts within the network that we are a part of there as well. But with that, we're going to go ahead and ride off into the sunset. Hope that you stay safe and you stay healthy, and we will see you soon.
In a world infatuated with comic fandom, comes a show to help us remember the talents that have inspired us.
Whoa, 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 cut.
Oh, come on, it wasn't that bad.
It's a bit dramatic. Let's just tell them about the show, guys.
We are the Canned Air Podcast.
Join us weekly for a comedic trip through pop culture.
We also welcome some cool comic creators, as well as some of the voice and screen actors that helped shape your childhood.
Find us on CannedAirPodcast.com and on the Evergreen Podcast Network.